understand, by the CIA, wasn't he? And what do you think the significance of this is for understanding German politics?
I think it's very significant, actually, because yes, he was recruited by the CIA. He was also paid by the CIA to do his work. And although he was not the head of the SS intelligence, and it was military intelligence that he was in charge of, privately, he maintained his anti-Semitic views. So he conducted his organization in line with those views as well. He also did hire former SS officers into positions within the German intelligence service. And just to be clear, it's not like this was really a new organization. What really happened is that the CIA employed Galen's existing organization that was in place under the Nazis to run the post-war German intelligence service, which was then called the Galen Organization, but became the BND. Effectively, they're the same thing. And we've seen the consequences of this in more recent years. There was still very close cooperation between the BND and the Americans. For example, in 2014, it was revealed that the US, the NSA, had been working with the BND to wiretap and listen in to German politicians. So the question is whether or not the BND is working primarily for the German state, or in fact the US state, and I don't think that has been properly addressed yet.
Right.
And also how much, right-wing, far-right politics still plays in the organisation and has historically played in the organisation. Yes.
Well, let me just go to David. I mean, one of the things that I think a lot of people would be interested in is why is it Germany is so pro-Zionist? I mean, do you think it's just simply guilt, or what other reason could there be?
Well, there's a sense in which the guilt's part of it, and it's the way in which the guilt becomes part of the political culture, which is important. But also, of course, the relationship with Americans and the very early on relationship between Galen and the Mossad. So he contacts the Mossad in the 50s, and they have a really quite close relationship from that point on. And that's part of the tale as well. So that in 1967, you have the intelligence about the Egyptian and the Syrian Air Force being passed through an ex-Nazi officer in Galen's organisation to the Mossad, which allows the Israeli Defence Force to eliminate, effectively, the whole of the Egyptian and the Syrian Air Force, and thus allowing them much more easily to occupy the territories which they currently still occupy.
Mm. I mean, Phil, would you say it's a stretch to suggest that the BND was effectively an asset then of the CIA? I mean, if so, I mean, do you think it's still an asset of the CIA, in your opinion?
I think it was definitely an asset of the CIA originally. The Galen organisation certainly was, and the BND, of course, grew out of that. And I think we shouldn't be drawing too much of a distinction between the two, because Galen also served as the head of the BND after it was renamed. So we are looking at really what is effectively the same organisation. And as I mentioned before, there's been very close cooperation with the Americans over the years and into recent years. Whether or not it's currently an asset of the CIA, I don't know exactly. But like I said, there's evidence of the BND working against German politicians with authorities within the United States. So it's definitely a possibility, and it's something that we should be looking at very carefully. And I think this becomes increasingly relevant and important in light of the events over the war on Ukraine. For example, you've had Nord Stream 2 being blown up, and the German government has effectively shrugged its shoulders. And you know, we believe, so it's been reported, that actually those responsible for the destruction of Nord Stream 2 might be the Americans or the British. And so in which case, you've got German allies working against the interests of the German people, and possibly with the support of the German state, which is a bizarre situation to be in. And so we really do need to take this very seriously and look at it closely.
No, And talking of bizarre situations, David, I mean, Galen collaborated with the Mossad way back in the 1950s, didn't he?
He did. I mean, it's a bizarre situation, isn't it? I mean, you have the sort of vision of the BND, the Foreign Intelligence Service of the Germans, working against the interests of the German state, of the German people, and indeed, as Phil has been saying, you know, systematically through this period, spying not just on the left like we do in this country, but also on the right. Very, very many of the German leaders were spied upon by the German intelligence, and indeed, the CIA seemed to have been involved in some of this in terms of the channeling of money from the CIA into German foundations and to German journalists to pay for them to pump out propaganda which reflected US interests. Now, of course, the whole relationship with Zionism is pretty extraordinary. So we have this collaboration with Mossad, and what appears to be an ongoing collaboration with Mossad, so it's literally unthinkable for the foreign policy establishment of Germany to take any position which is in any way against the interests of the State of Israel.
Well, we're just going to have to pause there for a moment, just to have a look at the so-called left party in Germany and how it's been captured by the Zionists.
The German left party, known in Germany as Die Linke, has an appalling record on Palestine. Back in 2011, it was condemned by the BDS National Committee for patently false, intellectually and morally dishonest claims that equated calls for the boycott of Israeli goods with anti-Semitism. In 2019, when the German parliament overwhelmingly voted to condemn BDS as anti-Semitic, some Die Linke members voted for it, while others put a contending motion also opposing BDS. In a 2021 interview, Dietmar Bartsch, co-chair of the left parliamentary group in the Bundestag since 2015, revealed how a trip to Israel had changed a lot for him. His capture by Zionism was prompted by visiting Israeli cities that have been hit with rockets. He rejects BDS out of, quote, historical responsibility. One of the most farcical elements of the collapse of the notionally pro-Palestine Die Linke came in Toiletgate in 2014, when journalists David Sheen and Max Blumenthal were booked by Die Linke to give a talk and then banned by Die Linke leader Grigor Geissi. Video footage showed Geissi retreating to the toilet and locking himself in to evade questions, especially on smears of the journalist as anti-Semitic.
This is cowardly behavior. This is anti-democratic.
You're supporting the state-sanctioned racism. You're trying to make our lives worse. I'm going to go back to Israel, and I'm going to be slagged as an anti-Semite because you chose to spread the lies. I don't know what that means.
Later, undercover footage revealed that Toiletgate was set up by key Zionist activist Benjamin Weinthal. Weinthal says he serves as the eyes and ears in Europe of the Washington, D.C.-based Foundation for Defense of Democracies, an uber-Zionist think tank which directs Zionist regime links.
Yeah. You have to be sort of an uber-tribalist counselor. You have to exaggerate to get these ideas across because they don't understand what contemporary anti-Semitism is, many of them.
Why is Die Linke particularly bad on BDS and Palestinian rights? Partly, it's the overwhelming subservience of German politics, both to the US and to Zionism and Israel. The extent to which Die Linke is designed to control the left rather than give expression to its demands was highlighted in a US State Department cable released by WikiLeaks, where the party's parliamentary leader, Gregor Geissi, told U.S. Ambassador Philip Murphy that the left's party's official policy on NATO, that it should be abolished and replaced by a new security alliance, including Russia, was only a ruse to avoid the more dangerous path of pulling Germany out of NATO. Die Linke today is in crisis, and even its own leaders have remarked on its inconsistent and contradictory approaches to many major issues, including the NATO proxy war in Ukraine. Die Linke is at best controlled opposition and is a clear obstacle to developing support for the liberation of Palestine in Germany.
David, this so-called Toiletgate affair seems a very strange event, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's Max Blumenthal, famously the editor of The Grey Zone in America, and David Sheen, who lives in his identity quite a lot of the time. Yeah. And they were invited to give this talk, and the pressure was put on them, on Die Linke, and they were cancelled. And Gysi runs along and locks himself in the toilet. If you watch the full length of that video on YouTube, which is available if you have a look for it, he actually does it twice. He runs away and locks himself in the toilet twice. David Sheen's comments, I think, are the most appropriate, where he says, "Look, I live in Israel. I've got to go back there,
yes.
And I'm now being accused of being anti-Semitic. This actually puts me in danger."
Indeed.
And of course, it puts him in danger and his Zionist Jews in danger, certainly. But this is how Palestinians are kept in danger every single day.
Yes, extraordinary. Well, Phil, I wonder whether you could tell us about the think tank associated with Die Linke.
Well, associated with Die Linke is the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation. Now, to understand the role of this organisation, it's important to recognise that it's not unusual in terms of German government-funded foundations linked to political parties. That there's quite a few of these. So, the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation is a political foundation affiliated to Die Linke. It's one of several of similar foundations in Germany. But the interesting thing that got me intrigued with the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation is its role in funding British left-wing media. For example, Novara Media has received funding from the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation. And I know from the research that I've done that the money that comes from the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation is actually, for these kind of projects, is actually, it comes from the German Foreign Office and the German Foreign Development Office as well. So it's, the Novara Media is effectively being funded by the German Foreign Office via the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation. And I think that's very interesting. I think it's also a bit concerning that we have supposedly, or what we'd like to believe, are independent left-wing media in this country actually receiving funds from the German state, which, as you've just outlined, is really terrible on issues like Palestinian rights. And actually, Novara Media's coverage of, for example, the anti-Semitism crisis, so-called anti-Semitism crisis within the Labour Party, really was not very good. And in many respects, legitimised quite a lot of the kind of the underlying logic and principles of the new definition of anti-Semitism in the articles that it published.
Yeah. So are you saying then, Phil, that the role of the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation in funding platforms like Novara Media is kind of problematic then?
That's my opinion. I believe that because reading through the annual reports, it's available online. This is public documentation. There's nothing secretive about this. Is that the German Foreign Office obviously sets the kind of boundaries through which these funds, these grants are managed, and so there is government oversight over what they're used for. And with all kind of funding, you have to think that there's probably some form of restrictions attached. With regards to what can be funded, what kind of organisations can be funded. And therefore, we are looking at the involvement of a foreign state in supporting particular points of views in this country, whether that's explicitly or implicitly through the funding relationship they have with them. Also of note, I think, on this, and of concern, real concern, is that the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation and indeed Novara Media have both been platforms for journalist Paul Mason, who was revealed to have collaborated with British intelligence by the Grey Zone again, who were featured in that video. And so, again, Paul Mason is very pro-NATO.
Yeah.
And the fact that you've got somebody like him being platformed quite prominently by the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation and the media organisations that it funds is interesting and very concerning, and does suggest that this isn't quite as radical and...
Let me just move on to David then, Phil, if I can. I mean, I wonder whether, David, you can tell us a bit more about the Foundation for Defence of Democracies. I mean, is there a link to the Ministry of Strategic Affairs in that?
So this whole thing, the Toiletgate affair, was set up by this guy, Benjamin Vintal, who rang up the press and got some articles in the papers, and then rang up the Israel lobby groups and got them activated. And he is the eyes and ears, as he puts it, of the Foundation for Defence of Democracies, which is a DC, Washington DC based think tank, which of course is very close and well known to be close to the kind of Likud line on matters of foreign policy. But it's not only that, it's not only close to Likud, it's actually directly involved with the Israeli state. So in the Al Jazeera program on the lobby in the US, the head of the Director General of the Ministry of Strategic Affairs has filmed an undercover footage saying, yes, of course, if we want to do that, we have the FDD. The FDD is effectively, in that footage, seen as being simply an instrument of the Ministry of Strategic Affairs as part of their anti-BDS campaign. So, yeah, this is, again, an instance where we see issues raised in Germany or the UK or the US by Israel lobby groups, which have a direct connection to parts of the Israeli state.
Yeah, I mean, and this WikiLeaks cable from 2010 is interesting. I mean, what does it tell us, do you think, about the uneasy coalition that created Die Linke?
So Die Linke is a coalition which was intended to bring together the left from the former West Germany and from the East. And so you had an organization which came out essentially of the Communist Party from the East, brought together with some people who were on the left of the Social Democrats in the West, and they had left the Social Democrats. And there's three parts, essentially, to the Die Linke coalition, and it's an attempt to bring them together. And for a while, it was quite successful electorally. But, of course, the problem with it has been that it's been it's compromised on many issues of principle, and it looks from that cable, this is a cable from 12 years ago now, it looks from that cable that many of these the issues on which they've compromised were compromised because they were always compromised. Gysi talks about the NATO position they have as a fraud, as essentially an apparent left-wing policy, which they didn't really mean, but they did it in order to avoid the possibility of a proper left-wing policy. And so it looks like, from the very beginning, really, that Die Linke was a kind of controlled left experiment, which was to try and bring in parts of the ex-communists from the East and to avoid any genuine threat, either to the German state or to NATO, or, given what we've been talking about, to the CIA.
Well, it's very interesting, but unfortunately, we are out of time today. So I hope you've found the programme informative. I want to thank our guests, Phil Bevan, and, of course, our resident expert, Professor David Miller. And thank you again for joining us today. And we'll be back next week with more investigations and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
A new analysis finds that the U.S. war in Somalia was waged with no clear legal basis. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of Intercept wrote, "The United States has fought more than a dozen secret wars over the last two decades, according to a new report from Brennan Center for Justice at New York University's School of Law. Through a combination of ground combat, air strikes, and operations by U.S. proxy forces, these conflicts have ranged from Africa to the West Asia region to Central Asia, often completely unknown to the American people and with minimal congressional oversight. This proliferation of secret war is a relatively recent phenomenon, and it is undemocratic and dangerous," wrote Catherine Young, a Bright counsel in the Brennan Center's Liberty and National Security Program. "The conduct of undisclosed hostilities in unreported countries contravenes our constitutional design. It invites military escalation that is unforeseeable to the public, to Congress, and even to the diplomats charged with managing U.S. foreign relations," she added. "These clandestine conflicts have been enabled by 2001 authorization for use of military force enacted in the wake of September 11 attacks, as well as the covert action statute, which allows secret, unattributed operations primarily conducted by the CIA." The United States has also relied on a set of obscure security cooperation authorities that The Intercept has previously investigated, including an expose earlier this year that revealed the existence of unreported U.S. counterterrorism efforts in Egypt, Lebanon, Syria, and Yemen. A Bright document, so-called 127E programs, known by their legal designation in those countries, and 12 others, including Afghanistan, Cameroon, Iraq, Kenya, Libya, Mali, Mauritania, Niger, Nigeria, Somalia, and Tunisia, as well as a country in the Asia-Pacific region that has not yet been publicly identified. The 127E authority, which allows U.S. commandos to employ local surrogates on U.S.-directed missions targeting U.S. enemies to achieve U.S. aims, is just one of the three low-profile efforts analyzed in the Brennan Center report. Another 10 U.S. Code 333, often referred to as the Global Train and Equip Authority, allows the Pentagon to provide training and gear to foreign forces anywhere in the world. The FAR Mercure 1202 authority allows the Defense Department to offer support to foreign surrogates taking part in irregular warfare aimed at near-peer competitors like China and Russia. The report released recently offers the most complete analysis yet of the legal underpinnings, congressional confusion, and a Pentagon obfuscation surrounding these efforts, and explains how and why the Defense Department has been able to conduct under-the-table conflicts for the last 20 years. The Brennan Center's report underscores the need to shine a light on the defense activities that have been cloaked in secrecy for too long. At the bare minimum, the public and Congress need to know where and why we are sending our service members into harm's way. Representative Sarah Jacobs of California, a member of the House Armed Services Committee, told The Intercept, adding, "I hope this report strengthens the urgency of Congress taking back its war powers, eliminating existing loopholes in security operations programs, and ensuring our strategies match our values, goals, and commitment to our service members. Congress says understanding of U.S. war making is often no better than the public record, writes Ebright, adding the Departments of Defense diplomatic counterparts in the Department of State also struggle to understand and gain insight into the reach of U.S. hostilities. Where congressional oversight falters, so too does oversight within the executive branch. Ebright's analysis is particularly illuminating in the case of Somalia, where the United States developed two key proxy forces, the Dana Brigade and the Puntland Security Force. The CIA began building the Puntland Security Force in 2002 to battle the Al-Qaeda-affiliated Al-Shabaab and later the State in Somalia, or ISS. The force was transferred to U.S. military control around 2012 and went on to fight alongside U.S. Special Operations Forces for a decade. In Puntland, we built that capability, training them at the tactical level and in how to support themselves and follow a good counterinsurgency strategy against Al-Shabaab. Don Bulldog, the former chief of Special Operations Command Africa and now the Republican candidate for Senate in New Hampshire, told The Intercept in a 2019 interview. Ebright notes that the proxy fighters were largely independent of the Somali government, despite being an elite armed brigade and one of Somalia's most capable special operations units. And their relationship with U.S. forces was long kept secret, with U.S. officials disavowing the presence of military advisors in Somalia until 2014. More troubling, the analysis suggests that for a significant period of time, there was no clear legal basis for U.S. military to fight alongside and direct these forces. The Obama administration designated Al-Shabaab an associated force of Al-Qaeda and thus a legitimate target under 2001 AUMF in 2016. That administration did the same for the ISS in 2014, but ISS has never been publicly identified as an ISIS-associated force by any administration. This means that the Pentagon developed and fought alongside the Puntland Security Force from 2012 and the Dana Brigade from 2011. Under the 127E and 333 Security Cooperation Authorities, before the AUMF was judged to authorize hostilities against Al-Shabaab and ISIS, much less ISS. The Department of Defense is unequivocal that it does not treat 333 and 127E as authorizations for use of military force. The reality is not so clear, writes Ebright. After all, U.S. forces have used these authorities to create control and at times engage in combat alongside groups like the Puntland Security Force and Dana Brigade. Over the last 20 years, presidents have consistently claimed broad rights to act in self-defense, not only of U.S. forces, but also for partners like the Puntland Security Force and Dana Brigade, which Ebright notes potentially allows the U.S. to fight remote adversaries in the absence of any congressional authorization. Representative Jacobs said it was difficult to assure the military community in her San Diego district that we are doing everything we can to keep them safe when Congress has such little information, let alone oversight over when, where, and how we are using military force. Attempts to avoid scrutiny from Congress and Congress's own abdication of war powers is central to how we ended up in forever wars, the spike in civilian casualties, and fail the strategies that waste taxpayer dollars and fuel very conflicts they are trying to solve. The report offers suggestions for improving congressional and public oversight, enforcing the balance of war powers within the government, and preventing hostilities unauthorized by Congress. Ebright writes, repealing 333, 127E, and 1202 would return the balance of power to where it stood before the so-called War on Terror. Forcing the Pentagon to convince Congress that building foreign proxies abroad is in the United States' national security interest. This is critical given that working by, with, and through foreign surrogates and allies is key to the Pentagon's global vision. According to the Biden administration's recently released National Security Strategy and National Defense Strategy, both of those documents underscore that the DoD views security cooperation as the future of its approach, Ebright told Intercept, adding, meanwhile, on Capitol Hill and in the broader public, we don't have conversations about what this means, to the detriment of voters understanding where we are at war and how this is going to affect military involvement and entrenchment abroad.
Insight. Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing Iran's strategic naval force with the commander of Iran's Navy, Admiral Shahram Irani. But first, this brief analysis.
In the early 20th century, U.S. Navy Admiral Alfred Mahan theorized that in order for a nation to be the primary global power, it needs to control all the major naval choke points located in the world's oceans and seas. He theorized about the vital geostrategic importance of what he named, quote, the Middle East, the area that is Western Asia, and the connecting point between Asia, Africa, and Europe. His views were enthusiastically adopted by the British Empire, the dominant empire of the time, who in the wake of the decline of the Ottoman Empire began to dominate the region. This meant that no local nation was allowed to develop naval power as a rival to Britain, including Iran, which had a naval tradition going back to ancient history. The United States inherited the strategy of global naval dominance following World War II, when it became the inheritor of the British Empire, including the part related to not allowing regional nations such as Iran to develop their naval capabilities. All this changed after the Islamic Revolution in Iran and the imposed war in the 1980s, which saw Iran gradually develop its navy into the strategic force that it has become today. Today, the Iranian Navy is challenging the lie spread by the U.S. Navy that it is providing so-called security in the region by providing real security in cooperation with other regional nations and advocating the expulsion of all foreign navies from the region and showing that their presence in the region is redundant. The Iranian Navy has also shown its ability to fly the flag in distant seas, from the Caribbean Sea and Latin America to the English Channel and the North Sea to the Straits of Malacca and the South China Sea. As Iran takes its place as a rising power in the post-American multipolar global order, so will its strategic naval power increase, and the world will witness its permanent naval presence in the world's oceans and seas in cooperation with its strategic partners from around the globe.
Admiral Shahram Irani, commander of the Iranian Navy. Thank you so much for joining us on Insight. As we spoke before the program, you know, our program tries to look at the current events and the events that occur in the news from a more strategic and historic perspective. In our previous programs in the past two seasons, we've talked a lot about the geostrategic plans and geostrategic different views that have existed among Western strategic planners, all the way beginning with Halford Mackinder, which were more focused on land and on issues related to the army and geo in terms of land and geostrategics. And we mentioned very briefly in some parts the marine and naval aspect of this, which at the same time as this was happening at the end of the 19th century and the 20th century, we have people like Admiral Mahan in the United States theorizing this global British, American, Anglo-American empire from a marine perspective, the idea that in order for Britain and then America as the inheritor of the British Empire following World War II, in order for them to rule the world, they have to control all the strategic choke points, marine choke points in the world, places such as the Strait of Hormuz, Bab al-Mandab in Yemen, Suez Canal, Eastern Mediterranean, the Dardanelles, the Bosphorus, Straits of Bosphorus, exactly our region of the world, the most important strategic region as they have been claiming for over 100 years. And I wanted to get your more technical analysis of this, the fact that maybe for the first time in this 100 years, we have a local power after the demise of the Ottoman Empire at the end of the, at the beginning of the 20th century and the end of the 19th century when it was already starting to decline, that we have for the first time in this region a local power increasing and showing its power both in terms of its land forces but also its navy. And we are at the point now where we have the leader of the Islamic Revolution declaring the navy of the Islamic Republic of Iran to be a strategic navy that has to go all around the world to defend Iran's interest and to project Iran's power. So I would like to begin our conversation with your analysis of this historic background and how we can tie it in with what's happening today in Iran.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحیم. خیلی خوش آمدید. خدمتتون عرض بکنم که همونطور که اشاره فرمودید خب منطقه ما یه منطقه بسیار راهبردیه.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful, warm greetings to you all. I would like to emphasize that, as you mentioned, our region is a very strategic one. The Indian Ocean region, especially the northern part, is considered to be very special thanks to its straits and waterways. The second reason is that this region is the connection point of three continents. In addition to these points, the most important feature of this region is that it is a global economic highway. When we talk about the three continents, the Americas are also indirectly affected. This conveys a clear message about the characteristics and the strategic of this region. But first, I want to describe the significance of the sea. About 70% of the Earth's surface is covered by water. 80% of the world's population live at least 200 kilometers from coastal areas and developed cities were mostly established next to the coast or its close hinterland. Today, it is rare to see these newer cities on the coast or on the banks or even behind the coast, which was previously common among people. 90% of global trade is done through sea. The reason is a term in geopolitics called access advantage. That is, the sea gives you access advantage and one can be present wherever the sea permeates. And the dimensions of this influence are unlimited as this can be from bays to the oceans. Well, the point you mentioned regarding the fact that in the past 100 years, some people have noticed its significance in terms of political geography and have focused on this field is absolutely correct. But I would like to go back a little further. Looking at the past, we must pay attention to the fact that, in line with colonial policies, they always pretended that they have the upper hand in the field of science and knowledge, and the output of this science and knowledge becomes industry. And the manifestation and crystallization of this industry emerges in the marine field. When you vacate and abandon the coast from the very beginning, you've actually assisted the policy that the colonialists have pursued from the beginning, the policy of creating fear and nightmares in the hearts of the residents of these coastal areas about the sea. According to the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, wherever our people went into the sea, they only went knee-deep and did not dare to go further and experience the depths of the seas and oceans. Well, how was this fear imposed on our people and the people of this region? The answer is that since our countries were rich in natural and underground resources, especially hydrocarbon reserves, they occupied us with the center and pushed us away from the coast. And they created a situation that the only attraction of the seaside for our people was to travel to the north or south of the country to enjoy watching the sunrise and sunset, and that's it. Well, this was a diversion. On the other hand, they tried to highlight one or two people in this field. For example, as you mentioned, Alfred Thayer Mahan, an American naval officer who opposed a theory that if someone wants to dominate the world, he must dominate the seas. So what does this dominance mean? Simply put, it means presence in the sea. This is very clear. Now let's get back to the maritime history of the Iranian nation. When you look at the corners of this ocean, Iranians are present in many countries. Now my question is, how were these Iranians be able to immigrate to these countries? At that time, there were no airplanes, and it was not possible to construct a road on the sea. Now, it's not a secret that the Iranian nation has dominated the seas before these Westerners had maritime power. This maritime power includes science, education, industry, ship production, and more, which I'm not going to go into much detail now. These Iranians have gone to places in the Indian Ocean region and further to China, where they must have traveled there by sea. Well, in the first stage, colonialism created a historical disconnection between the Iranian nation and the sea, and it diverted our attention from the seas towards the center, and this created the illusion in the Iranian people that the sea is a scary thing. Even in their movies, they presented the sea with terrifying storms and creatures such as giant octopuses and sharks. But inside their own countries, they created the belief that the sea is a very kind environment. Whales are our friends, and you can even get close to sharks. Well, they tried to create a bond and connection between themselves and the sea, but fear and worry between Iranians and the sea. This policy of colonialization caused us to fear maritime presence and avoid the seas. Now, what is important in the matter of maritime presence is authority. As you mentioned, presence in the seas means power and authority. This stems from the fact that the sea is the embodiment of power and, in the words of the leader, the power of your naval force and combat unit in the sea. It is there that you can see the peak of authority. The first message that a frigate or a submarine sends out is that the country that builds them has acquired the required knowledge to dominate the sea. When you reach a continuity of presence in the sea, it shows that your country has gained the ability to achieve the two characteristics of stability and permanence. Third, your country has succeeded in turning its knowledge into an industry and can remove the fear and illusion created by the colonial powers. Well, when this happens, you have taken a very big historical step. One of the messages that was institutionalized in our people and brought about by the glorious Islamic Revolution of 1979 was that the Iranian nation can achieve whatever it wants, and it can achieve whatever it is determined to achieve. But what is the foundation of this movement? It is definitely the people. It means that human power comes first. But the point is that the human force that is supposed to be present in the sea and symbolically display your authority must be a special human force. It should be a force that goes through the training courses properly, learns science properly, never surrenders to the harsh environment of the sea. Because you as a sailor must first fight with the nature. That is, your first war is with nature and your next war is with the enemy who wants to encroach on you from this path or play a hostile role. Will it turn out like this in our country, that when the Iraq-Iran war broke out, a historic operation was carried out in the sea in the shortest possible time during the eight-year sacred defense? There was an impression that the Iranian Navy is a completely dependent force. And of course, this impression was completely correct, because first, naval training was held abroad before the Islamic Revolution. Second, naval equipment had to be provided from abroad. And in fact, no equipment belonged to the Iranian Navy, and it had no plans for military independence either. Third, the base of its maintenance and stability and its presence in the sea were the military advisors who were present in Iran before the revolution. At first, after the revolution, if a vessel, for example, went to the sea and something went wrong, we couldn't do anything anymore. You had to find a military advisor, and he would go to the sea to repair the vessel, and more importantly, they would not allow you to enter such specialized areas at all. Even the limited training they gave were at the user level. As a result, when the revolution occurred because of this unfavorable situation and the military advisors leaving the country, a happiness was formed in the hearts of the colonialist powers, because they assumed that the policy and the doctrine or strategy that they had applied had yielded results, and Iran was left with a paralyzed navy which only owned a bunch of limited equipment and no knowledge, and it would not be able to do anything. Thus, a war was imposed against Iran, and this was where the will of Iranians and their religious, cultural, and national teachings showed themselves and rushed to help Iran. From the very place that the enemies assumed would be Iran's weak point, Iran's navy dealt the strongest and deadliest blow to the enemy. That is, in less than 67 days into the war, we could cut off the economic artery of the enemy and, in fact, completely eliminated the enemy's presence in the sea. It came as a shock to everyone. At that moment, they suddenly came to their senses and realized that they were wrong. Well, despite having the equipment, Iran had no knowledge. So how did it manage to become a power in the sea? This is the starting point. The starting point is here. The period of history that you mentioned has a history like this. That is, first, there was fear and illusion about being in the sea. And then there was a disconnection from the sea. The will of the Iranian nation removed that disconnection and created the possibility of being in the sea. What happened? The enemy, who was in the guise of Iraq's Ba'athist regime in Saddam, tried to come and take possession of the sea again, which means that the same policy and doctrine that you brought up earlier was behind this case, gaining dominance by missile war or by airplanes. It is always asked that 67 days into the war, Iran had managed to completely remove the enemy's navy from the scene. It cut off Iraq's economic artery. So what is the point of having continuous presence in the sea while it had nothing else to do? Well, no, that wasn't the case. The enemy did not give up aggression and resorted to other measures to strike Iran. It tried to target Iran's economy as a countermeasure. That's exactly why we convoyed about 10,000 cargo ships and tankers and ensured their security during the eight-year sacred defense. Among these 10,000 ships, 252 were threatened by the enemy's attacks, of which less than 10 to 15 ships sank and the rest managed to reach the shore safely thanks to Iran's help. Well, here the economic artery of the country remained stable, and this stability is not only limited to the sea, but also transferred to the land, and the necessities of life of the people were provided. Well, we passed this stage too. So what happened? For 8 years, we had to fight back in a war waged by Iran's enemies. We did not have much time. Our military equipment wore out and the combat units were exhausted. So does this mean that the maritime presence was no longer needed and we should have given up? No, this presence must continue. Here actually began a new chapter in the history of Iran's naval force that continues to this day. What happened? In the last days of the war, April 18, 1989, the great Satan, I mean the United States, became so desperate that it directly attacked this exhausted naval force. The U.S. Navy, in a cowardly fashion, entered into a direct war with Iran, with all its might. In this war, our Sabalon frigate was damaged.
So, excuse me, Admiral, so you're saying that we come to the point in the war where the Americans become so desperate because they're seeing that their puppet, Saddam, and the Ba'ath army and navy is not able to fulfill its duty according to the Americans. It reaches the point where the largest, most powerful navy, as they call it, directly enters into the war and directly fights against the Iranian navy. Is this what you're trying to tell us? Is that correct?
من اجازه میخوام که اینو یه مقدار بازتر بکنم. اشاره فرمودید به یک کشور.
Okay, let me open this up a little bit more. You said one country, but it wasn't like that. The West and the East united against our country and joined hands to line up against us. And the result was that not only the Iraqi Ba'athist regime, but also the Eastern and Western worlds were disappointed. That is, they saw what they had hoped for, and none of their strategic actions were fruitful. The seedling of the revolution grew and grew tall and became very strong and did not stop. Therefore, they entered the war directly, and their war against the Iranian nation was completely cowardly. I mean, they did not dare to fight face to face. There was not supposed to be any clashes between Iran and the U.S. at all. Well, our enemy was defined in the war. In appearance, it was the Ba'athist regime of Iraq, and everyone supported him. But here, America enters directly and targets our frigate with a laser-guided bomb. One of our frigates sinks into the sea. It was named Sahan, and it belonged to the Islamic Republic. Of course, we have built a better one today. From here on, as I said, a new chapter of our history begins. The naval force rescues the Sabalan frigate, along with its commander and staff, and brings it to the shore while its spine was damaged. Based on all mathematical, scientific, technological, and industrial formulas, it was impossible for them to remain on the water. But the will of the Iranian Navy managed to bring this frigate back to the shore. So what happened then? Was the frigate thrown away? Of course not. The next will of the Iranian nation is manifested here. That is, the decision is made to repair Sabalan frigate, which is completely achieved. But under what conditions? Under the conditions of sanctions, threats, and constant conspiracy. In the end, fortunately, the Sabalan destroyer returns to the field of naval operations in the shortest possible time, and this is where the country's universities and Iranian youth enter the scene of the scientific campaign at the same time. Operational and military experiences are transferred to them, and they are informed about what is happening in the world. With the help of the Iranian elite and scientific community, the Sabalan frigate is built. However, it is no longer the previous frigate, except for the body and the outer shell. Its missile system and its sonar system undergo many changes. When the young generation manifests this ability, here the commander-in-chief of the Iranian armed forces, Ayatollah Khamenei, announces a new command. After visiting the progress of the work, he asks, "Why don't you enter the construction phase?" and issues this historical decree. That is, at the very beginning of the work, we go for building frigates. The leader further said, "Build a frigate, build a good one, one that can also carry helicopters." At that time, our frigates could not carry or accompany helicopters. They did not have a flight deck. Therefore, a new phase begins here. We began with repair and overhaul, and then moved towards improvement of the equipment, and this progress continued until we gained the knowledge of building military equipment. At that time, we felt the need that it's time to go underwater. Therefore, the first subsurface vessels were purchased, 3 submarines. But can this help us if a crisis occurs? Again, the answer is no, because the knowledge did not belong to us. Therefore, at this point, the country's navy enters the field of submarine construction, and fortunately, today we have the ability to build 2 classes of submarines. Well, how do you expect your enemy, who is under the illusion that the world's seas belong to them, to feel when they see your naval power? Certainly, it'll experience a feeling of geopolitical suffocation, because it sees in front of it, or next to it, a navy that has grown and is standing on its own feet. A navy whose entire support comes from its people, its youth, and has relied on its own universities and industry. A navy which has no problems to be present in the seas and wants to reassert itself. This is a historical moment for the Iranian Navy, and a new chapter is beginning, which is called the Strategic Navy, according to the leader of the Islamic Revolution. Well, here it is necessary to reiterate then, as you said, the environment of this region is very special. Among all these seas, the northern Indian Ocean is distinctive and exceptional. The enemy is trying to make this area unsafe through piracy.
Thank you so much for joining us on Insight. So what insight did we gain from our conversation with Admiral Irani? Despite the massive advancements in aerospace technology that humanity has experienced in the last century, the oceans and the sea remain the dominant form of economic and commercial interaction among humanity. And the existence of naval capabilities remains a vital necessity for most nations. Ancient nations with ancient naval traditions, such as Iran, were not allowed to develop their naval capabilities in the era of Anglo-American global naval dominance in the 19th and 20th century. Particularly in West Asia, the geostrategically most important region of the world. Following the Islamic Revolution and the imposed war, Iran began to gradually develop its navy into a strategic force which today is providing maritime security in the region and flying the flag in distant seas from Latin America to Northern Europe to East Asia. This is a result of the general awakening of the Iranian nation following the Islamic Revolution, which has resulted in Iran rapidly advancing in all social, political, economic, technological, scientific, and military fields, including naval power. Iran is establishing a permanent naval presence in the world's oceans and seas in cooperation with its strategic partners from around the world, with a focus on joint security and naval diplomacy, but also power projection when necessary. Thank you for joining us on this episode. Until the next time on Insight.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the Limelight.
The United Kingdom is facing skyrocketing inflation, which has been unprecedented for decades, prompting thousands of British people in various industries to strike over payments. We take a look at the World Press and Media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us.